Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with a follow-up to the bombshell revelations by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh in the London Review of Books, challenging the Obama administration's account of the SEALs raid that killed Osama bin Laden, an article that has been condemned by the administration and mainstream news outlets, but is picking up steam in terms of the veracity of the walk-in, a senior Pakistani intelligence officer who betrayed the bin Laden-ISI relationship in return for the $25 million reward. Christine Fair, professor of the Georgetown University's Security Studies Program and author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, joins us to argue that this does not necessarily refute the White House version of how the CIA tracked down and killed bin Laden. Then we look into President Obama's setback in the Senate, where Democrats blocked his so-called Trade Promotion Authority for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The March Trade Deficit and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as well as look into the TPP and how it is less of a deal to stimulate trade, but more of a giveaway to powerful multinational corporations. Then finally, we'll examine the new report from the Pew Research Center that finds America is getting less Christian and less religious. Claude Fisher, a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Still Connected, Family and Friends in America Since 1970, joins us to discuss the growth of unaffiliated Americans among the millennial generation that could be a reaction to the crass and punitive politics of the religious right. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of the International Institute of Strategic Studies, Women in International Security, and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And it seems that in this story that Seymour Hersh has published in the London Review of Books that has been refuted or at least rejected by the White House and the Pentagon, parts of the story, though, have been supported, for example, by NBC News, and that is the part of the story about the so-called walk-in who provided the United States with information where Osama bin Laden was being sheltered by the ISI, the Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence Agency. And now the Pakistani press are reporting that the walk-in's name is former ISI Brigadier General Usman Khalid. So what's your sense of, to me, that in itself is a pretty significant story, isn't it?
That ISI walk-in tipped off the U.S., the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden?
Right.
Yeah, if that's true, that's obviously huge. So look, in the grand scheme of things, I think there's two things that we know. What Seymour Hersh reported is not the entire truth. What the administration has said is not the entire truth. And what's knowable, I certainly don't have the wisdom to inveigh upon that. But what I think has been bothering people about the story for quite some time is the common sense notion that someone had to have known that Osama bin Laden was there, especially given his proximity to the Pakistan Military Academy. So that there is this walk-in that tipped off the United States, it at least conforms the common sense expectation that someone knew. It still doesn't answer the question whether or not the DGISI knew, whether or not the Army Chief, these larger questions about complicity, that they had, in fact, stashed him there. These are questions that certainly linger. I've been dubious that the chief of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, would know. If for no other reason, why would Osama bin Laden trust him? But I think this is an important piece of information that we haven't had before. It doesn't mean that other parts of the White House story is incorrect. I mean, typically, in these kinds of operations, you have multiple leads and multiple sources of information that converge upon a possibility that a high-value target's in a particular place. It doesn't mean that these other things didn't happen, but this does at least conform to expectations that someone within the ISI knew about this.
Well, in terms of the official story so far, it certainly refutes the whole, the movie Zero Dark Thirty, the whole idea of the length to which the CIA went to track down the courier, etc., and the use of torture, by the way.
I don't think it does refute that. First of all, a walk-in from the ISI comes into the embassy and puts down this story about Osama bin Laden. If you were the person receiving that piece of information, that's going to be fairly pretty hard to believe. And depending upon the timelines, the United States may well have been working on, and in fact, if we take the courier story at face value, and by the way, I have a lot of reasons to believe that is the case because of the individuals at the agency that were working the story. This is in no way, shape, or form an invalidation of that process. Absolutely not. If anything, you could imagine developing both of these sources of information independently. But there's nothing about this walk-in that says that the efforts to follow the courier were all a bunch of nonsense. There's nothing in this that makes me think.
Well, I was about to say, though, that doesn't it refute the idea that somehow torture was involved and it helped, and that's been the excuse for that?
No, but actually no one of any sense has said torture has helped. That has absolutely been refuted from the beginning.
Well, Rodriguez wrote a book about it. I mean, the CIA guy wrote...
People that want to say that the information, the courier, came from torture, this has been very hotly debated. This came up in the Senate review of enhanced interrogation techniques. There is nothing about that story that says torture helped. And there are strong opponents of torture who've said that, in fact, had torture not been used, we may have been able to learn about this courier much earlier. So this courier tale, whether or not it's true, it has nothing to do with the validity of torture. And I'm going to push back on that because there's been a lot of debate. And anyone that has tried to use that to say enhanced interrogation techniques works is there's about 10 people for one lined up on the other side saying it doesn't work. So I think we should keep that whole narrative completely apart from this, which is the story is, and the Pakistan press has supported it, there was a walk-in. That there was a walk-in from the ISI does not invalidate any other effort that the CIA or other national intelligence means may have had to try to identify bin Laden. It simply says that there was another piece of information.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fares, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of the International Institute of Strategic Studies, Women in International Security, and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War. But the more explosive charges that are in the Seymour Hersh article are about the idea or the speculation that he puts forth that once this walk-in from the ISA told them about bin Laden, the U.S. then went to General Pasha and General Kayani and said, okay, we caught you cold, and that somehow they essentially were bribed into allowing this raid to take place. But of course, not take credit for it because of the backlash in their own country.
That's the part of the story that I find most preposterous.
Uh-huh.
As soon as the U.S. would have made it known to, let's just pretend that in fact this is true, that they had in fact put him on cold storage and they were waiting to cash him in on a good day, and the United States went to them with that story, he would have been out of there in a heartbeat. There's absolutely no way that the President of the United States, once tipped with this information, would have trusted the ISI to facilitate this raid. That to me is the most nonsensical part of the story. The fact that there was a walk-in, completely plausible. But that we're going to believe that Obama went to Kiani and Pasha and said, yeah, we heard you're sitting on him, and we want you to facilitate a raid? No, not a chance.
So did Obama then, I mean, after the Jimmy Carter debacle in Iran, one could understand why presidents would want, much, if not 100% certainty that this thing wasn't going to blow up in their face. So is your sense that Obama really did take a huge risk there and that I mean, the walk-in, what do we know that the walk-in told them? I mean, the name and address?
So that's the thing. That's why I'm not a big fan of speculating about the assumptions being presumed, right? What we know is that what we know, and it's been confirmed, and so I'm going to put no in scare quotes, that there was a walk-in. CAA gets walk-ins all the time. What did this walk-in tell them? We don't really know. But to my point of view, based upon the folks with whom I am familiar in this general racket, I have no reason to believe that the story about the courier is not also absolutely true. That there was a walk-in, that is a completely independent source. So I don't have any reason to not believe that this wasn't a huge risk. I mean, from the folks that I know about the mock-up of the compound, the practice exercises to go in, these are all things that appear to be real, unless these are multiple points of fabrication that have been injected into our popular culture about this raid, which is possible. I'm just not prepared to believe there's been that elaborate of a perception management campaign about this raid. So I don't see anything in this about the walk-in that makes me think fundamentally different about the courage that it took to plan this raid. And I certainly do not believe Pasha and Kiani were a part of this.
Well, it does have...
And if you were to just go back and you were to look at the relationship that the United States had with Pasha and Kiani, at that point, you will remember that the Raymond Davis affair had just taken place. We were in a pretty serious confrontation over drones, over G-locks. There is no way that Kiani and Pasha would have acquiesced to facilitating a U.S. raid to get this person, Osama bin Laden, that they had stashed away and were hoping to cash in on a good day. There's just nothing plausible about that.
And Raymond Davis, of course, was the CIA contractor that shot a couple of Pakistanis who I think were ISI people tailing him, or at least something along that.
Yeah, they were ISI contractors. He was a CIA contractor. They were ISI contractors.
So that doesn't...
And, oh, by the way, this is another important part of the story. I know for a fact that for about a year or more prior to Osama bin Laden raid, the United States was cramming in as many CIA folks as possible. And this was something that finally blew up in the Hussein Haqqani issue with Memogate. So everything that the United States was doing in that year prior to the bin Laden raid is consistent with what we've been told, which is increased intelligence, increased assets in the country. There's nothing, if you simply look at what the U.S. was doing in that year prior, it is very much consistent with major stroke or major outlines of the official story.
Well, in your case, you're certainly no fan of the ISI, are you? I mean, haven't they threatened you? Haven't they killed some of your friends?
Well, not only that, they threatened me with gang rape. So I'm not in a... By the way, what I'm saying about the ISI is not that they're good guys. I'm actually saying that they are dangerous sponsors of terror. And Osama bin Laden is not so stupid that he would have found himself in the position of the ISI basically being his cage master. So I'm not saying anything to the credit of the ISI. I think they're absolutely duplicitous. What I'm actually saying is if in fact they had managed to get a hold of him by some stroke of genius, they would not simply have acquiesced to the Americans conducting a raid. What in the world would they have gained from that? In fact, all one has to do is look at the media fallout. I mean, they look like a bunch of monkeys. I was there the week that bin Laden was killed, and Pakistanis were genuinely confused about whether they were a failed state or a complicit state or both.
Well, in terms of being a complicit state, if the walk-in is credible, and there's some indication that he is, and if bin Laden was being held by the ISI, and we don't know how far up the chain the knowledge went, does that lead to the speculation that he was therefore what they call an asset? And then you have to ask yourself, well, how long was he an asset? Before 9/11?
My issue is not that he was an asset. So the way the Hearst story, convoluted though it is, and actually this information comes from the stash of tapes and correspondence that were captured at the bin Laden residence. About 4 months ago, a bunch of information was released that very high-level Pakistani military and civilian officials were negotiating, were in a negotiation process with al-Qaeda. And that process basically said, you know, we will leave you alone if you leave us alone. And the Sharifs were involved with this, and obviously the military had been involved in this for quite some time. So the idea was that al-Qaeda had made the Pakistani state a target. And the first known targeting of this really goes back to 2004, when Zawahiri basically said that that Pakistani should try to kill Musharraf. And then there were several attacks upon Musharraf. And what the military and the civilians were trying to do through this negotiation was basically call truce to al-Qaeda and to get al-Qaeda to back away from the Pakistani Taliban. And so basically go back to status quo ex ante, where al-Qaeda did what al-Qaeda wanted to do in the region but didn't target the state, and the state in turn would not in turn target al-Qaeda but would instead simply focus upon the Pakistani Taliban. So the Hirsch article basically says that they were trying to negotiate with bin Laden to kind of use him as leverage so that the rest of his organization wouldn't target the state. Now, obviously, if they have Osama bin Laden in their custody, why didn't Osama bin Laden simply tell his organization to stop targeting the Pakistani state? Right? So there's huge logical holes and inconsistency with the story that Hirsch is promoting, that they were basically using him to get al-Qaeda off the back of the state. But we do know that the state was trying to negotiate with him through these intermediaries, which, again, we know this from the stash of materials from the Osama bin Laden hideout. Why would he have to go through this elaborate ruse if, in fact, he's sitting there right there in Abbottabad? So other parts of the story don't line up with what Seymour Hirsch is telling us to believe.
Just in closing, though, Chris, if this was a low-level, unauthorized, off-the-books ISI operation, and assuming that this ISI Brigadier General that tipped them off, Brigadier General Usman Khalid, was either involved or knew about it, doesn't it raise serious questions about command and control? This is a nuclear state, after all, Pakistan.
Well, see, actually it doesn't. And this is what you and I, we've talked about this before. The problem with understanding Pakistan is that it uses terrorist organizations as tools of foreign policy. And so you can go anywhere in the country, and there are going to be terrorist safe houses. And everyone knows that they're safe houses. Everyone knows this. And everyone also knows that these safe houses are under the control of Pakistanis just call them agencies. They're under the control of agencies. And so if you happen to know this infrastructure of militant hideouts, you can stash someone away there without actually calling any greater attention to yourself, as long as you play by the protocol of treating that as a militant safe house. You have to understand, Pakistan has raised over six decades now dozens of terrorist groups that it uses to operate in India and in Afghanistan. This is standard operating procedure. That you would have a sympathizer within the ISI for Osama bin Laden isn't a surprise. If I were Osama bin Laden, I would probably want someone in charge of my safety that had been retired from the ISI, someone that I had worked with back in the day, someone that I could trust. I would be very reticent to trust myself in the hands of any of these newer personnel with whom I had no contact. So if you understand how Pakistan has this network of terrorist safe houses that are run by delegation on behalf of the state, this makes perfect sense. And because they are delegated through a combination of active serving ISI officers as well as retired, I mean, they have like these Blackwater organizations just like we do. Raymond Davis was a CIA contractor, right, retired from the military, working for the CIA. It's entirely plausible because this is how the state protects its terrorist infrastructure. it is standard operating procedure. So ironically, it all raise issues of command and control. It's actually functioning as it's supposed to, which is keep these terrorist assets safe while shielding APEC's leadership from knowledge of any particular safe house housing any particular terrorist.
Well, Christine Fair, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a great night.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and professor at Georgetown University Security Studies Program, who specializes in South Asia security issues. She's a member of the International Institute of Strategic Studies, Women in International Security, and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The March Trade Deficit and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And today was a dramatic day, in, at least for the president, in the Senate, where the Democrats blocked the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement. And you've tied it in with the March trade deficit. So what's the connection?
Well, we have a big problem with our trade deficit. This is basically a drain on demand in the domestic economy. And it's sort of an interesting story here, because economists generally haven't worried about the trade deficit because they haven't worried about demand. So if you assume, as the conventional story in economics is, that the economy just tends to full employment of its own, then the idea of a trade deficit is, okay, that's fine. That's going to finance more domestic consumption, more domestic investment. There could be some composition issues to be concerned about, but we don't have to worry about demand because it's assumed we're at full employment. Well, now many, if not most economists, I hear, I'm thinking mainstream people like, you know, Larry Summers, you know, Paul Krugman, who, you know, certainly was a very mainstream economist, always moved some to the left. They recognize we're below full employment and we're likely to be below full employment for some time to come. In that context, when you have a large trade deficit, as we do, over $500 billion on an annual basis, that's a serious loss of demand that's not easy to make up. And what I've argued about this is we had these trade deficits in the 90s. We had them in the last decade. We made up the demand in the late 90s with the stock bubble. We made up the demand in the last decade with the housing bubble. We don't have another easy way to do that. Now, many people are looking at the growth of the economy. They're looking at the growth of jobs, the fall in the unemployment rate. They're going, okay, well, we're fine. We're on a path to full employment. And I don't think that was ever true, but I think when we got the first quarter data, which showed the economy barely growing, and with the March numbers on trade, it's going to show a shrinkage in the first quarter, then it becomes very clear we're not about to get to full employment. And the big culprit here is the trade deficit. And just to remind everyone, if we don't get to full employment, workers don't have enough bargaining power to see wage gains. They aren't going to get the benefits from growth. So it's a really big deal. And I bring this back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership because this is an opportunity to do something about the trade deficit. The reason we have a trade deficit is simple. The dollar is valued too highly against other currencies. We have to have the dollar drop against other currencies. China's is the most important here, but far from the only one. And that requires some mechanism to get the other countries to raise the value of their currency. We've chosen not to include that in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You don't have to do it there, but we haven't done it elsewhere. And the question is, if we don't have in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when are we going to address the currency value? When are we going to get the trade deficit down? So that's the connection. And to my view, it's a really big deal, because if we don't get full employment, if we don't substantially tighten up the labor market, most people don't see any of the gains from growth. And that's really a huge matter.
Could you add to the lack of demand? You've said until we get to full employment, you won't have sufficient demand. My understanding is that wages have been flat in this country since the 1970s, and people turn to credit to maintain their standard of living, and most people are maxed out. Is that a factor in demand?
Well, that's a little bit of a factor in demand, but the trade deficit swamps that. So people have made a lot, including me. I wrote a book about Plunder and Blunder, the Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, and I talked about the fact that we've had an upward redistribution of income has hurt demand. But the extent to which that upward redistribution of income's hurt demand, it's swamped by the trade deficit. You're talking about something that's three or four times as important. So the fact that we've in effect, because keep in mind, that's redistribution. The money that, you know, the worker at, you know, Walmart or McDonald's or, you know, even a factory worker, the money that they're not getting, that's going to someone else. And they do spend most of it. They don't spend as much, you know. So when it's going to shareholders at Walmart, they're not spending as much on average as, you know, what the workers would. Obviously, workers would probably spend pretty much their whole pay. So they're not going to spend as much, but they are spending a big chunk of it. So the impact of that redistribution from workers to higher income people is really swamped by the impact of the trade deficit on demand.
Well, it sounds like Walmart is a good example, because isn't Walmart all about the trade deficit in terms of what they sell, Chinese products, et cetera?
Absolutely, and this is part of the problem of, you know, why we can't address the trade deficit, because, you know, if we just describe that and just go, hey, you know, we have this big trade deficit, why don't we get the value of the dollar down so that, you know, we could have something closer to balance trade? And just to be clear to people, the reason why I raised the dollar, bring up the dollar in this context, is if we had a lower value dollar, the dollar bought 20% fewer Chinese yuan, Japanese yen, euros, whatever we have on the list, what that means is all the imported goods cost that much more relative to domestic goods. We'll buy domestic goods then rather than imported goods. Flip, same story on the other side. If the dollar will buy 20% fewer Chinese yuan, that means that their currency, you know, from the standpoint of someone in China, their currency buys more dollars, so our goods are cheaper to people living in China. That means higher exports to China. So that's why the value of the dollar is so central here. And the reason why we can't just say, oh, this is just common sense, bring the value of the dollar down, well, we all agree on that. Walmart's a big factor here. Walmart isn't anxious to see the dollar fall, because they've made a big point over the last two decades setting up low-cost supply chains in China and other countries. You go to them and go, hey, isn't this a great idea? We're going to have all those goods you're importing now cost 20% more. What's that going to do to your profit margins? They're not anxious to see that. Same thing with a lot of manufacturers. General Electric has more people employed outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. They aren't anxious to see, you know, the cost of those goods that they're, you know, the refrigerators, all the things they're producing in other countries. They aren't anxious to see those costs of those goods go up. So we have a lot of people who have a very direct interest, a lot of powerful corporations that have a very direct interest in keeping the dollar overvalued and, in effect, perpetuating the trade deficit. They don't really care whether we get to full employment or not. In fact, they might even be happier if we don't. But let's just say for the moment, they don't really care.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The March Trade Deficit and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So given that the president didn't get his so-called trade promotion authority that 52 Democrats voted to start the debate on the bill, they were short of the 60 that was needed to overcome a Democratic filibuster, and 45 senators voted against the TPP. And of course, we know that there's been a rather public feud between President Obama and Senator Elizabeth Warren. So when you talk about broadening the agenda, the thing that seems to bother those Democrats that are leery of the TPP, and particularly Elizabeth Warren, is quite simply the history of our previous trade deals. Now, we've just got through talking a lot about China, but my understanding about the TPP is that it excludes China, and the Chinese think it's designed at doing exactly that. So what's in this deal that's good, or how much of it is based upon fears of past deals as opposed to an understanding of what this deal does? Because I know Obama basically tried to scold Elizabeth Warren into, you know, more or less saying, you know, you don't get it. What doesn't she get?
A few different points here. First off, the issue about China. It's not in the deal now, but the deal is quite explicitly written with the intention of being expanded and ultimately including China. So again, this is one of these silly things that people have been lecturing Senator Warren and others that, oh, it doesn't even include China. Well, they know full well, at least they should. It's the explicit intention to bring other countries into the pact, including China front and center. And many people, again, many people in the administration have said this. The intention is to write rules that are favorable to the U.S. or U.S. corporations. I'll come back to that in a moment. And have China accept those rather than, in fact, have China set its own rules. So that's a story in China. That now, the point Elizabeth Warren has raised, and I think President Obama is just being, you know, duplicitous and trying to misrepresent this. He's going, oh, my deal won't do X, Y, and Z. One question. We don't know what's in his deal. He doesn't make it available publicly. So that's an important point. He's derided her for saying it's secret. I'm sorry, it is secret. If it's not secret, give me the website where you can find it. It is secret. That's not a disputable point. But the other point that Senator Warren has made, and this is very fundamental, he's asking for fast-track authority that will extend 6 years. President Obama, whether we like him, dislike him, whatever, he's out of the White House in January 2017. None of us know who's going to be in the White House at that point. So even if, you know, best of intentions, everything, we didn't have someone else in the White House in January 2017, that may well be a Republican, and that may well be a Republican who wants to gut Dodd-Frank and do a lot of other things that I don't want, Senator Warren doesn't want, perhaps even President Obama doesn't want, and we won't be able to stop that because they have fast-track authority now. They could put up any trade agreement they want and have it approved with a 51 votes in the Senate. It won't be subject to a filibuster. So that's one of the main points that Senator Warren has argued, and she's exactly right on this. It's really not a debatable point. This is all, you know, these are the rules that he wants her and the rest of the Senate to vote on. The other point, you know, who is it designed for? Well, the people negotiating this deal were overwhelmingly business interests. If you look at the representatives on the working group, I think it was 80 or 85% were executives of major corporations or representatives of trade groups. That's who was sitting there. So what do you have here? You have the people from the pharmaceutical industry, the entertainment industry, the auto industry, whoever it might be. They sat down and they said, here's what we want in a trade deal. So what do you think you get? You get a very business-friendly trade deal. That's who was sitting there. They obviously, you know, you don't expect that the pharmaceutical industry sat down there and said, how can we draft up a trade deal that, you know, promotes public health? You know, not to say they're bad guys. I mean, I don't think they're trying to hurt public health, but they're there to make profits for their company. And that's what the trade deal is about.
So is there an argument to be made about economic patriotism? Because the people that you just mentioned that have negotiated this TPP in secret represent corporate America and big multinational corporations. And we know that they're all guilty of parking massive amounts of profits overseas. And we know that if people in this country, particularly the wealthy and the corporations, paid their fair share of taxes, we wouldn't have any economic problems to speak of. And there'd be no problems with the entitlements and the deficit and all of this other stuff that conservatives keep wringing their hands over. So is this really about economic patriotism in a sense that some of the Democrat senators, and I guess Rand Paul as well, that voted against this, basically are arguing for the American worker as opposed to these multinational corporations that have already demonstrated their lack of economic patriotism?
Well, I don't know if it's a question of economic patriotism. I mean, I sort of take it for granted that the businesses, the corporations are there to make profits. And, you know, they've pretty much told us that as explicitly as they can. They're going to do what's profitable. And if that means shipping operations to Mexico or Malaysia, wherever it might be, they're going to do that. If they can get away to shifting their profits there so they don't have to pay taxes, they're going to do that. They said that. I mean, you know, so at this point, you know, I think it's kind of moot. It's just silly. You know, they've been as explicit as they can, but they're about making profits. So they aren't actively trying to screw the United States, but if they could find a way to make profits, that means they reduce employment here, pay less taxes here, they're going to do that. End of story. So I think the question here is whether you're looking at a deal that's good for corporate interest or is good for the country as a whole.
And the answer is pretty obvious, isn't it?
Well, I mean, as I say, this is drafted by corporate interests. It is secret. And, you know, I think it's reasonable to assume that they drafted a text that's very much in their interest. And one of the points, I was going to make this earlier, but it's really important to understand, it's often talked about this massive trade deal. It's going to open up for trade. And people say stuff, well, don't you want us to trade? This is just silly. We trade a lot already. We aren't going to stop trading if we don't pass TPP. The idea you're an isolationist if you oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anyone who says that is either silly or doesn't know what they're talking about. The bulk of the countries in this agreement, sometimes here, you know, 40% of the world's population or world's GDP is covered by this, and, you know, such a lot, 40% of U.S. trade, most of that is already accounted for in trade agreements that are in existence. So Mexico, Canada, 6 of the 11 countries are already in free trade agreements with the United States. So that's nothing new. So the idea that we're going to have a massive increase in trade as a result of this is really just nonsense. What we're talking about is putting in place a business-friendly regulatory structure. That's what most of the deal is about. Trade is really a side point. If they're just doing it to reduce the tariff barriers, the remaining tariff barriers between the 11 countries in the TPP, no one even wastes their time, you know, fighting over it. It's just not that big a deal.
So in terms of what motivates the senators, and some of them are certainly supported by unions, and the unions, of course, are getting weaker and weaker in this country, but most of the arguments I've heard have been basically saying, you know, all of these deals like NAFTA, et cetera, have been heavily advertised, and great promises have been made about how they will stimulate income and jobs and we'll all, you know, go back to Jack Kennedy's idea of rising tide raises all boats. Nobody's buying that. And on the other side, my understanding about so far, you know, these international trade agreements, particularly in the context of what's loosely called globalism, surely it's pretty clear, isn't it? The evidence is pretty clear that the winners so far from globalism have been poor Chinese and wealthy Americans on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, the story that there'll be some huge gains from the additional trade from this deal just really don't hold water. And there have been some studies done by very pro-free trade groups. Peterson Institute for International Economics did an analysis, and they came up with an increase in GDP when it's fully phased in 12 years from now of about 0.4%. So that's about 2 months of growth. And the point I make about that, even that is almost certainly a huge overstatement, one, because they assume full employment in their models. But the other reason is that they don't make any deductions for the ways in which it increases costs. So here I'm thinking first and foremost, I was talking before about patents and copyrights, that, you know, a large chunk of this is increasing patent and copyright protection, which raises prices and discourages trade. And this is a really big deal. I raise this to people and they look at me, people have to pay more for drugs. That's true, and that's a real big issue. But even more than that, in addition, it's a very big economic issue. So if you look at, you know, the hepatitis C drug, Sovaldi, that's being sold here in the patent-protected version for $84,000 for a treatment, $84,000. Now, you can get the generic version, high-quality generic version, for less than $1,000 in India. You're going to have a lot more drugs being sold at the patent-protected price rather than generic price. That's the same thing as an enormous tariff. That's like a 10,000% tariff. And, you know, people like to distinguish. They go, oh, that's a patent. That's not a tariff. Markets don't care. They react the same way. And, in fact, particularly in the case of drugs, because of people's health and because there's so much asymmetry of information, the drug companies know what their drugs do much better than doctors, certainly much better than patients. It's particularly problematic because drug companies then have a huge incentive to mislead people about the safety and effectiveness of their drugs, and they do it again and again and again. So this idea that this is a free trade pact, that's nonsense. It actually, in many ways, is a protectionist pact. It will raise a lot of trade barriers, and those may well be more important in an economic sense than the reduction in the modest reduction in tariffs that we're going to see. And certainly when you consider the health impact of raising the price of drugs by a factor, in many cases, of 10, even 100, that's a very serious deal.
Well, my understanding is that what Senator Warren is most concerned about is the TPP's enforcement mechanism known as the Investor-State Dispute Settlement. And it sounds from what you're telling me that's the kind of disputes that they'll settle. In other words, whether you have to pay $84,000 for an American corporate protected drug that most people on the planet can't afford, or whether you can get the generic version for $1,000 from India. Is that what this mechanism is going to be about? And is she right in suggesting that the drug company that's selling the drug for $84,000 is going to win in that before that dispute settlement forum?
Well, that's certainly one of the possibilities. Just to be clear, it's a very, very strange animal. When I first heard about these dispute settlement mechanisms, I actually didn't believe the person told me just because it sounds so far-fetched. In effect, what it does, you have these three-person panels. Foreign investor gets to bring suit. You or I don't get to bring suit. So if a foreign company is, you know, polluting our drinking water or doing whatever, we don't get to use them. It's totally one-sided. It's only that the investor, so, you know, if we have a foreign investor in the U.S. or a U.S. investor in another country, they could bring a suit against the government. It could be a state, local, or federal government. So it doesn't matter. They could bring against any level of government. And they get to appoint one person to the three-person panel. The national government gets to appoint one person. And then you have a process through which the third person selected essentially jointly between the two parties. So one of the issues Elizabeth Warren's raising is, okay, suppose some measure gets passed possibly at the federal level, but suppose at the state or local level. Suppose a state or a local county government bans fracking and you have a foreign oil company that says, hey, we want to frack. That's a violation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, they get to appoint one person. Then let's hypothesize, who knows who's going to be the president in 2017, but imagine it's a President Jeb Bush or President Scott Walker who thinks it's fine that companies frack. They get to appoint the second person. Then we have, together they'll appoint the third person. Well, what's that ruling going to be? If, the state of Pennsylvania or New York, as it's recently done, they've banned fracking, what's going to be the ruling? And here, too, President Obama's played games. He said they can't overturn laws. No, they can't overturn the law. So what they could do is, the state of New York bans fracking. So the three-person panel, one person appointed by the foreign oil company, one person appointed by Jeb Bush, and one person appointed jointly, they go, hey, that's a violation of the agreement. We can't overturn the law. We're just going to charge you $100 million a year for your fracking ban. So you're welcome to keep it there as long as you want. You'll just have to pay $100 million a year to this foreign oil company for nothing.
Wow.
So that's the sort of thing that Senator Warren is worried about, and I would say with some pretty good cause.
Well, Dean Baker, I think you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press and is the author most recently of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, The March Trade Deficit and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun?
By which we measure our pain, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Claude Fisher, Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, where he focuses on American social history. He's the author of Made in America, A Social History of American Culture and Character, and Still Connected, Family and Friends in America Since 1970. Welcome to Background Briefing, Claude Fisher.
Thank you.
And there's a new study out by the Pew Research Institute that suggests that America is becoming less of a Christian nation. The share of the population that identifies as Christian has declined significantly in recent years. And according to the Pew Research Center, the biggest decline is amongst millennials, which, of course, arguably are the future. So how significant is this given how much our politics on the right in this country have effectively been captured by the religious right?
Well, I'd put it, first of all, in some kind of context. We have seen, since around 1990, an increase in the number of Americans who, when asked about their religious affiliation, will answer the question with something on the order of, "I have none," especially if they're offered that option, "What religion are you?" And given the option of nothing or no particular religion. There's been an increase in that number, substantial increase. It started about 25 years ago. My count and I have identified that in earlier data. And I think the Pew report basically documents a continuation of that trend. Part of the trend involves generational differences. So as each new generation since the early 1990s has entered into our survey data, that is, turned 18 and older, they've shown a lower rate of declaring affiliation with a particular religious tradition. And that's the general trend. I think their numbers this year are basically consistent with numbers they published last year and numbers they published the year before and so on. That's the basic trend. Now, there are a number of analyses and arguments about how one should interpret that trend, and I'd be glad to get into that.
Well, what seems to be happening, though, here is that that there's been a sort of a drop-off amongst those who identify themselves as Christians, particularly amongst adults. 34% of American adults identify with a faith different from their childhood faith.
Well, that's a different issue. There are two different. Let's separate the issue of changing religions to declaring yourself as having no particular religion or not having a religious affiliation. Americans have been famous compared to people in other countries, other Western nations, in changing religions for generations, whether it's changing denominations among Protestants or it's going across a Protestant-Catholic divide or back the other way. That's one phenomenon. It's, I think, been pretty distinctively American for many generations. The other phenomenon is one I mentioned before, which is declaring yourself as having no particular religion or no religious identification. Sometimes people will declare themselves as spiritual but not religious. That is, as I said, a phenomenon that really started taking off in the early 1990s and continues on now.
Well, I brought it up to just to contrast it with what the study suggests is that Hindus, Muslims, and Jews are the three religious groups with the largest retention rates. In other words, people don't switch from childhood religion to adult religion. 80% of Hindus, 77% of Muslims, and 75% of Jews still identify with their childhood faiths. So I don't know what that says about.
I think that's there are a couple of factors there. One is that all three of those religious traditions involve a strong component of, you might say, national, ethnic, or tribal affiliation. Famously, among Jews, there are many who declare themselves as Jewish by heritage and yet don't believe in God or aren't particularly religious. It's a particularly Protestant and therefore a particularly American view of the world that religion entails a sort of theology, and therefore one of the other distinctions about American religion is the sort of sense that if you wake up one morning and you're now not sure about your theology, you go searching for a different one or drop religion altogether. And so it's not surprising that Protestants are particularly volatile in their religious affiliations.
And again, I'm speaking with Claude Fisher, who's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, where he focuses on American social history. He's the author of Made in America, A Social History of American Culture and Character, and Still Connected, Family and Friends in America Since 1970. So I was just trying to relate this new Pew Research Center study with the politics of the day, as you know.
Yeah, and I do think there is a connection. And the argument that my collaborator Mike Hout and I have made is that the upsurge in this disaffiliation, you might say, since the 1990s, that is, Americans more and more likely to say, I have no religion or I have no particular religion, we think is rooted in a backlash among Americans, sort of center, left of center, against the politicization of religion, exemplified in the religious right. And I think you can see the timing pretty clearly. And there are other aspects to the phenomenon that suggest that a good component of it is a lot of people on the left or the moderate left saying, when asked about religion, well, you ask me about religion, when I think about religion, I think about, you know, anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-feminist attitudes, and the capture of parts of the Republican Party by Christian fundamentalists, or vice versa, the capture of certain churches by Republican activists. And so if that's what religion means in America today, count me out. So I think a lot of the dynamic is that. And as I said, I think you can time it pretty clearly to the early 1990s when it really started pushing hard in the political sphere. Then there's other things that go along with it. Robert Putnam, the political scientist who's famous for Bowling Alone, amplified some of the argument by suggesting that it is also a reaction among younger cohorts to the culture wars aspect of American politics and the attitudes about sexual repression and restraints on personal freedom. That also got identified by the politics of the 1990s and the early 2000s as connected to the church, and therefore sort of stained the church in the eyes of many young people. And then I think the other dynamic, and this is projecting into the future, is once some young people grow up feeling, well, organized religion, the church, is not for me because it violates my sense of sort of personal liberty. It seems tainted by this crass politics. Once they grow up that way, the question is, and they've alienated themselves from the church, the question is, what do they do when they become parents? And we may be seeing with millennials, in fact, that by the time you get to the second generation of this backlash against the religious right, you may be seeing families where parents have not made the connection to the church and don't make it even when they have children, which is usually time in life when most people reconnect themselves to the church. So that's an interesting other part of the dynamic, that is, this may have a phenomenon that once it's been loosened will sort of move on its own initiative, its own dynamics. And I know that people in the religious community have worried about this now since the phenomenon was identified about 15 years ago, that the involvement of the church in the religious right may have permanently, they fear, alienated, you know, a sector of American society from the church.
Well, the Pope seems to be taking at least the Catholic Church in a direction away from a fairly hardline right-wing theology, at least in terms of...
It's not clear yet how much of the theology he's going to touch, but the ideology, I think, is correct. And I think this is a very interesting experiment to see what role Francis might have in the dynamics of Catholics. Catholics and American Catholics have abandoned the Catholic Church at a high rate. I think there are a few dynamics involved in there, but certainly one of them for decades now has involved the Catholic Church's position on these cultural issues: women, abortion, gays, divorce, issues like that.
What about pedophilia? Do you think that's affected it at all?
Well, yeah, and certainly the Church has had its share of scandal, more than its share of scandals, not only the pedophilia, but the, you know, financial scandals and so forth, that's driven people away. But I think over the long term, it'll be interesting to see whether Francis can pivot the Church in a direction that makes it seem more welcoming to young Americans and perhaps stop or even possibly reverse the abandonment of the church by young Americans. There's always been a tension, always, I would say, for 150 years or more, tension between Rome and the Catholic Church in America, because of the extent to which Catholic Church in America has tried to accommodate itself to the more individualistic positions that Americans take on many issues. And Rome has always been a constraining factor, and therefore Church in America has been losing people at a relatively high rate. Whether Francis changes that, that's a very interesting question. And it'll take, you know, a while to see what he does, and then a while to see what difference it makes.
But meanwhile, in the state of Iowa, you have this peculiar competition with among the Republican candidates, a number of whom have fairly stellar Christian fundamentalist or religious right credentials. Scott Walker, who's perhaps in some polls is leading, he's the son of a preacher. So is Ted Cruz. Santorum is in there, of course. And Mike Huckabee is a former Baptist preacher. So it's odd, isn't it, to see all these people duking it out for what you're saying is a narrower slice of the pie, but yet, well, it's so significant to the Republican Party.
That's right. No, let's put this in perspective. All this stuff from the Pew Report and the New York Times coverage and everything else is about the growth of a tiny minority into a little smaller minority. Not by any means the transition from a minority into a majority. Let's put it into perspective. There are far, far more evangelical Protestants than there are skeptics, religious skeptics in America. There are far more Americans who, 80% to 90%, depending on how you ask a question, who say they believe in God. More Americans believe in creationism than evolution, I believe, the last time I looked at the data. So in that sense, those candidates you refer to are appealing to the great majority of Americans, loosely speaking, in terms of being religious. They are particularly, and their version of religion, their fundamentalist evangelical position, is not favored by most Americans, but they still got a large group. And they are a group, by the way, that has, since the creation of the moral majority in America in the late 20th century, been very politically active in ways that, for example, their counterparts on the left have not. They've tended to be relatively apathetic. And, of course, finally, this evangelical group plays a very important role within internal Republican politics. So that's, they go there because that's where the votes are, and that's where the activists are, and that's where the financial donations are. And so that's putting it all in context. That is a Pew Report, the rise in the number of people who claim no religion. It's an interesting phenomenon, but we're still talking about a relatively small minority in America.
Well, Claude Fisher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay.
And again, I was speaking with Claude Fisher, who's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, where he focuses on American social history. He's the author of Made in America, A Social History of American Culture and Character, and Still Connected, Family and Friends in America Since 1970. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.